Now on Radio 4 FM for episode 2 of our Book of the Week, The Zhivago Affair by Peter Finn and Petra Cuvée. Boris Pasternak has begun work on his novel, Dr. Zhivago. During Stalin's Great Purge, Pasternak himself was regarded with suspicion by the authorities. Now in 1946, he's about to become involved in another extramarital affair. The reader is Nigel Anthony.
On an October day in 1946, as winter announced itself with a driving snow, Pasternak met Olga Avinskaya, a blonde in an old squirrel fur coat and an editor at the literary journal Novy Mir. She was more than 20 years his junior and later was a source of inspiration for the character Lara in Dr. Zhivago. She lived with her mother and her two children. Avinskaya was seductive and devoted, clingy, and calculating. "I'm in love," Pasternak told a friend. Moscow was soon chattering about the deliciously scandalous liaison, and his wife, Zinuida, found out about the affair in the winter of 1948. Pasternak's sense of loyalty to Zinuida and their son became a strain as he vacillated between family and flame. The prospect of a second divorce, a third marriage, and all the potential excruciating chaos may have been more than Pasternak wished to endure. He imagined at one point that he could get Zinuida, Olga, and his first wife, Yevgenia, to sit together happily on the veranda of the dacha with him. By 1949, Pasternak was already a figure of some international renown, even if he was banished to the edges of literary life in Moscow. When a senior investigator in the prosecutor's office told Stalin there were plans to arrest Pasternak, Stalin started to recite Heavenly Colour, Colour Blue, a poem written by Nicholas Baratashvili, which Pasternak had translated. And then Stalin said, "Leave him. He's a cloud dweller." Avinskaya enjoyed no such protection. The secret police burst into her apartment, searching for any link to Pasternak. 6 months later, Avinskaya was sentenced to 5 years in a hard labour camp for close contact with persons suspected of espionage. In October 1952, Pasternak suffered a serious heart attack and was rushed to Moscow's Botkin Hospital. As with so much else, he explored his condition through Yuri Zhivago, who was bestowed with similar cardiac problems. "It's the disease of our time. I think its causes are of a moral order. It's impossible, without its affecting your health, to show yourself day after day contrary to what you feel, to rejoice over what brings you misfortune." After he recovered, Pasternak alternated between paid translation commissions and Dr. Zhivago. He had little expectation that his novel would ever be published. On March the 27th, 1953, in the wake of Stalin's death, the new leadership announced a broad amnesty for prisoners, including women with children and those sentenced to 5 years or less. Avinskaya, thinner and ruddily tan from long days in the fields, returned to Moscow. The dacha in Perejelkino was adapted for winter living, with a gas supply, running water, a bath, and 3 new rooms. Pasternak started to live in the village all year round, and kept some emotional distance from Avinskaya for several months, but the affair had resumed by 1954. And that summer, Avinskaya rented an insulated room in a nearby house so she could be near Pasternak. He commuted between his wife, in what he called the big house, and his lover's pad, the ritual of lunch and lazy afternoons with Avinskaya before returning home for dinner. Mornings were reserved for writing. Avinskaya now began to act as Pasternak's literary agent, managing his affairs in Moscow. Stalin's death created the expectation of greater imaginative freedom. In early 1954, Pasternak's translation of Hamlet was performed in Leningrad, and in April, a literary magazine, Znamya, published 10 poems from the set planned for the end of Dr. Zhivago, the first publication of original material by Pasternak since the war. He He was allowed to write an introductory note describing Dr. Zhivago. A doctor, a thinker, a seeker after truth, with a creative and artistic cast of mind. Pasternak spent much of the winter in Perugino, working intensively on the novel's last chapters. On December the 10th, 1955, the novel was complete. You cannot imagine what I have achieved. I once again renewed and redefined the dearest and most important things, land and sky, great passion, creative spirit, life and death. In February 1956, at a secret session of the 20th Congress of the Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev launched an astonishing attack on Stalin. He said the former hallowed leader was guilty of the gravest abuse of power, and that during Stalin's rule, mass arrests and deportation of thousands of people, executions without trial, created insecurity, fear, and desperation. The delegates in the Great Hall of the Kremlin sat in stupefied silence. The CIA, which obtained a copy of what became known as the secret speech, leaked it to the New York Times. The sense of change was short-lived. It would die with the Soviet invasion of Hungary. But it was in this brief hiatus, in May 1956, that Sergio D'Angelo arrived at the wooden gate of Pasternak's dacha in Perugino, a chocolate-brown two-story building with bay windows and a veranda. D'Angelo found the 66-year-old writer working in his front garden, where the family had a vegetable patch among the fruit trees, shrubs and flowers. Pasternak greeted his visitor with a firm handshake. D'Angelo explained that he worked at Radio Moscow, where he had heard news of Pasternak's novel. His other job, he said, was to look for new Russian literature for a recently formed publishing house in Italy, run by an Italian communist called Gian Giacomo Feltrinelli. D'Angelo proposed that Pasternak should give him a copy of Dr. Zhivago so that Feltrinelli could have it translated. Pasternak told him that the manuscript had been gathering dust at the state publishing house for several months, and he had no real hope of it being published in Russia. D'Angelo assured him that Feltrinelli would, of course, wait until publication in the Soviet Union before bringing it out in Italy. Dr. Zhivago had found a publisher. Feltrinelli didn't read Russian, so he sent it to an Italian Slavist. Judgment was swift. Not to publish a novel like this would constitute a crime against culture. Pasternak seemed quite pleased with himself after giving the book to D'Angelo, but he also realised that those close to him might think him reckless. Ivinskaya was furious when she returned from Moscow, where she had been in negotiations with the state publishing house about a volume of his poetry. She realised that no post-Stalinist glow would shield a writer who defied the system by consorting with Westerners. She was also afraid for her own safety. "I've been in prison once, remember? And already then, in the Lubyanka, they questioned me endlessly about what the novel would say. I'm really amazed you could do this." Pasternak was a little sheepish, but unapologetic. To assuage her, he suggested she could sound out any official reaction to what he had done. Ivinskaya turned on her heels and went back to Moscow to see the poetry editor, Nikolai Banikov, who was familiar with the novel. Banikov was frightened by Ivinskaya's news. "How can anyone love his country so little? How can he fail to understand what he is bringing on himself and us as well?" In mid-June, Feltrinelli got down to business, discussing royalties and foreign rights. He had no sense yet that his possession of the novel would infuriate the Soviet leadership. Pasternak signed a contract with Feltrinelli. The Kremlin leadership quickly learned about contact between the two. The Central Committee's Culture Department prepared a detailed report on Dr. Zhivago for the leadership with a series of damning quotations from the novel. "Publication of this novel is impossible," the report concluded. For the next 2 years, Ivinskaya became the authority's conduit to the writer. She relieves me from the vexing negotiations with the authorities. She takes the blows of such conflicts on herself. In the end, her influence on him was limited. Pasternak was a self-aware and intuitive actor in the unfolding drama, and the key decisions in the matter, from the day he handed the manuscript to D'Angelo, remained his. Ivinskaya was soon summoned to meet Dmitri Polikarpov, the head of the Central Committee's Culture Department. Polikarpov said it was imperative that Ivinskaya get the novel back from D'Angelo. Ivinskaya suggested that the ideal solution would be to publish Dr. Zhivago in the Soviet Union as quickly as possible, preempting any foreign edition. "No," said Polikarpov, "we must get the manuscript back, because it would be very awkward if we cut out some chapters and they print them." Polikarpov, in front of Ivinskaya, then phoned the director of the state literary publishing house, Anatoly Kotov, to tell him to appoint an editor. "The editor should think about passages to change or cut out, and what can be left unchanged." Pasternak was unimpressed with Ivinskaya's efforts. "I am by no means intent on the novel being published at the moment, when it cannot be brought out in its original form." Pasternak continued that summer to hand over copies of the manuscript to various foreign visitors, including the French scholar Hélène Pelletier, who would work on the French translation of Dr. Zhivago. Pasternak entrusted Pelletier with a note for Feltrinelli. It was undated and typed on a narrow strip of paper. "If ever you receive a letter in any language other than French, you absolutely must not do what is requested of you. The only valid letters shall be those written in French." This would prove to be a prescient security measure that would allow Feltrinelli to distinguish between coerced messages and freely written ones from a writer who would soon feel the intense displeasure of the state. Isaiah Berlin, the Oxford Don, visited Russia that summer of 1956. Pasternak took Berlin to his study and pressed a thick envelope into his hands. "My book. It's all there. It is my last word. Please read it." Berlin plunged into the novel and finished it the next day. "I thought it was a work of genius. It seemed to me to convey an entire range of human experience." Berlin later concluded that Pasternak chose open-eyed to pursue publication, given the anti-Soviet tone of the book, fully realizing the danger to himself and his family. Berlin took a manuscript home for Pasternak's sisters in Oxford and had 12 copies made to circulate to Russians in England. In mid-September, the editorial board of the literary magazine Novy Mir formally rejected Dr. Zhivago. "The thing that has disturbed us about your novel is something that neither the editors nor the author can change by cuts or alterations. The spirit of your novel is that the October Revolution, the Civil War, and the social transformation involved did not give the people anything but suffering and destroyed the Russian intelligentsia, either physically or morally." There was now little reason to believe that even an edited Dr. Zhivago would be published in the Soviet Union.
Episode 2 of The Zhivago Affair by Peter Finn and Petra Cuvée was read by Nigel Anthony, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4. At midday, Call You and Yours is asking, what would make you happy? And should the government be using public money to make us all happier? We'd love to hear your views. The phone number to call is 03700 100 444 and Call You and Yours begins at 4 minutes past 12. Or immediately after the news, Jane Garvey will be here with Women's Hour.
Sir John Tusa presents The Leadership Gap.
In this series, I'm talking to British leaders to reveal the state of leadership in Britain today.
Leadership is all about change. You have to be pretty tough.
I've got an open door policy here. Everyone comes in and calls them sir.
The days in the NHS of the heroic leader have gone.
I think we've got absurdly out of kilter in the way that we pay some of the people in leadership roles in our organisations.
Well, not only did I not tell them, I didn't know they had done it. And that, for me, was a success.
The Leadership Gap, Friday morning at 11 on BBC Radio 4.